Hi, and welcome to Zed Games. Recorded live at 4ZZZ Studios in Brisbane and broadcast nationally over the Community Radio Network, Zed Games brings you the latest gaming news, reviews, and interviews from across Australia and around the world.
Welcome back, listeners, to another exciting year of Zed Games, your favourite radio show dedicated to gaming, news, reviews, and whatever else is left over on the side. We are coming to you live from 4ZZZ Studios in Brisbane. You might be listening to us around the country on the Community Radio Network. I am Lee, and joining me for this episode, we have Mr. Jody McGregor.
Hello, Lee.
As well as our Lord and Master, Razor.
Hello.
There he is. So what is this episode about, Razor?
Well, Lee, you and I have been playing Far Cry 4. We've had some co-op adventures. So I'm especially keen to tell everyone about how much fun we had.
Yes.
Did you shoot some honey badgers?
So mostly we ran away from them.
Oh, really?
They're really mean.
Uh-oh.
They will mess you up. They're awful.
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah.
Jody, you've also been playing This War of Mine?
Yeah, it's a bleak Warzone survival despair simulator.
I gave it to him for Christmas.
Thanks. He was cheery.
Awesome. But let's kick this episode off with the week in gaming news headlines. Mr. Jody McGregor.
Sony's game streaming service PlayStation Now will gain a subscription plan beginning 13th of January for North American customers. The subscription plan will cost US$20 for 1 month's access to over 100 PlayStation 3 games. It will be initially only available for the PlayStation 4, but Sony says that access from other devices, including Sony smart TVs, smartphones, and the PlayStation Vita, will be opening soon. Borderlands 2 creative director Paul Hellquist has left Gearbox Studios to join independent developer Robot Entertainment. Hellquist also led the design team for the first Bioshock while working for Irrational. His first project at Robot will be Orcs Must Die Unchained.
Oh, that's interesting. He's, you know, got some good things under his belt. That's a very different project that he's working on there as well.
Yeah, it is. I haven't played the Orcs Must Die games, but they're sort of like Sanctum, right, in that they're tower defense games where you run around in first person, and while your towers are mowing down orcs, you also mow down orcs?
That's right, yes. You build traps and hook them up in a... I think they've got a kind of Rube Goldberg-esque thing where you get springs or fans to blow orcs into spikes and stuff like that, which is right up my wheelhouse, and I don't know why I've never actually engaged with that. The second one has co-op as well, so you can help build absurd orc killing Rube Goldberg-esque devices with friends. Why are we here right now when we could be doing that? To hell with the radio. So long.
And Lee, you've got some news from the chipmakers Intel, right?
Yes. At CES today, Intel announced that they are going to be budgeting $300 million into a fund which the company will be using over the next 3 years to improve the diversity of the company's workforce and attract more women and minorities to the tech field to make the industry more hospitable to them once they get there. I think it's... They said that it is as a direct result of being embroiled in some of the Gamergate stuff last year.
So this is what they've achieved.
Yeah, this is what Gamergate they've achieved. They have they've given $300 million to women and minorities to enter the industry.
So, nice work.
I know, right? Yeah. So hooray. I hope they keep scoring own goals like that. Yeah. So that's really exciting that that's going to happen. So they'll be providing scholarships to universities that tend to favor women as well as minority groups, and also other programs to get people involved. And they're also trying to specifically target minorities to enter into their company in engineering positions and things like that. So that's amazing. That's really good. They're also they're partnering with a great many industry diversity organizations, in particular Feminist Frequency. So yeah, hardcore way to way to pick a side there, Intel.
I feel much better about having an Intel core in my gaming PC.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm pretty good about that now.
So that's great. You're listening to Zed Games, coming at you from 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Jody, you've been playing This War of Mine, correct?
Yes, I have. It's by Polish developers, 11-Bit Studios, and it's a survival crafting game set in a bombshelled modern-day city under siege. It's kind of like the anti-Sims. So, you know, in The Sims, you're always worried about whether you're going to have enough money to, you know, renovate your house and buy a plasma screen TV.
Not if you use the money cheat, like everyone does.
Everyone. I don't.
I don't either. How unethical,
it's
Ray.
Just you.
You're a thief and probably a coward.
Thief? Who did I steal from?
The money tree.
Yeah.
We're in This War of Mine, you're worried about getting enough food, getting clean water, whether you'll have enough beds for all of the survivors. You have like 3 or 4 people usually crammed into this one house, and you have to build everything that you need at the start of the game. You might get like a couple of things. You have like 1 chair, for instance.
Is it a good chair?
Not a great chair.
Oh.
So you might want a radio. You might want a heater for the winter. You might want a stove to actually cook some food on. You probably need animal traps as a way of getting food, and so that food you're eating is probably rats.
Mm.
It's pretty grim, and it has that... It's sort of like, you know, in XCOM, where you see your base, and it's sort of like that ant farm view?
Mm-hmm.
It's like that, only the ants scurrying around are these sort of very sad Eastern European people who are just struggling to survive. It is bleak as anything.
Right.
And then, after a day of that kind of stuff, at night, you choose 1 survivor to go out and scavenge so that you have enough stuff to survive the next day. You might want to go and trade, or you might want to just dig through the dirt looking for scraps, or you might want to steal from somebody. So you have like these options of where to go in the town, and you need to leave the other people at home. So you can only send 1 person out, and the others you have to choose, like, you're allowed to sleep, but you have to stay guard, and you have to stay guard. And then the person that you send out goes out with their backpack to, you know, an abandoned school that got bombed, or the hospital, which might still be full of doctors and nurses who are trying to keep a bunch of people alive. And then you just wind up scrabbling around trying to find wooden components and things, because it has this real, like, Minecraft-style crafting system. And also just food, and if you're lucky, vegetables, water, sugar. You also wind up trading with people, and weird things become valuable in wartime. So, like, coffee and cigarettes are your main currency, whereas jewelry, it's not really worth that much. Mm. But, you know, it's some really good alcohol.
Yeah.
Vital. And obviously bandages and medicine. So your survivors can get sick, they can get wounded, and they can also get depressed. And they can get so depressed that you might wake up in the morning and one of them has just committed suicide.
Blah.
So these are all of the things that you have to manage.
Yep.
So like I said, it's the anti-Sims.
Wow.
It's very much the opposite of that kind of game.
Yeah, so why would I want to play this game?
That is a good question, actually, because it's not the kind of game that you play if your reason for playing games is because you want to have fun. It's like watching a tragedy unfold. It's very much like watching one of those movies late at night on SBS where a bunch of people slowly die one by one.
Mm, yeah.
It's odd because it's inspired by real conflict. It's set in this made-up city called Pogoren, but the skyline and a lot of the events are quite explicitly based on the siege of Sarajevo.
Mm.
But at the same time, it doesn't really match up with a lot of, like, what I've read about that, like in, like, Joe Sacco's books and stuff, because a lot of what happened during that actual, like, 4-year-long siege was that people came together and whole streets were working together and patrolling together and helping each other out, and no one went out at night alone because that's how you got killed.
Right.
So it's not a great representation of, like, I guess you're not really learning anything from it. Like, what I would want from this kind of game, I want to be able to say, because it will teach you what it was actually like for people in horrible situations, and you will gain a deeper understanding of what it's like to survive through something like that. But I'm not, unfortunately, I'm not sure you will.
So this is taken a very video gamey approach and said that as soon as things go bad, everyone turns into a monster, essentially.
What it feels like is they took one of those survival games about the zombie apocalypse and took the zombies out. Mm. You know how in all of those games there's that layer, that theme of like, man is the real monster, which is a thing that we put in zombie games and TV shows and movies so that we feel good about watching them because they're serious, when what we really want is to watch, you know, somebody get eaten by a zombie and somebody else shoot out somebody's brains. Mm. So when you just take that out and leave it on its own, it's actually kind of facile and shallow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Once you take out the escapist element of that, it's actually kind of a cynical theme.
Man, like, I'm never buying you a present again.
So, sorry, Jody, you mentioned XCOM and The Sims as two games that you would compare it to. In both of those games, you get a sort of emotional connection with your characters after following their journey. You micromanage, you know, everything they do for so long that you can't help but feel attached. Is the same effect present in this game?
To a degree. I did, like, for instance, when one of your survivors gets depressed, you have the option of getting another survivor to talk to them. Mm. And it's one of the ways that you can cheer them up. You can also put some music on the radio. If you manage to craft a guitar, which I have never actually succeeded at doing, then you can play that. There are ways you can do this. But just by having them sit down and talk to each other, that was a moment where they actually felt like real people rather than, you know, backpacks that I was manipulating around from one crafting station to the next. They actually came alive for me in that moment. And in one of my games, it ended. I've never actually made it to the end point of the game where, you know, soldiers come and take you away and the war ends. I've died every time.
Right.
One of those times, what happened was my final survivor fell into such a depression that I couldn't convince her to stand up. She just sat on the floor for an entire day, and someone came to the door and started knocking, maybe to trade, maybe to ask for help, and I could not get her to answer the door. And
that is bleak.
And then the next morning, she'd committed suicide, and that was game over.
Hooray!
Wow.
Merry Christmas.
So yeah, it does make you feel for the characters, even though they don't have a lot of dialogue. It's just like little balloons of text that appear above their head while you point and click to move them around. Mm. And they have like a little bio and these sort of generic Eastern European E sounding names, but nothing too specific. I think they didn't want to actually make it too specific. Mm. And so the characters do feel kind of vague.
Reading accounts of other people's playthroughs online, one thing that keeps coming up is people feeling great deal of remorse about going out scavenging for goods, knowing that there's an elderly couple in the town, and then deciding that the best thing that they can do is go over there and steal food from them. You and I were discussing this last week, and you said that you never ended up in a situation where you actually felt like you'd been pushed into making that dark a decision. Did the game progress to a point where you actually did have to engage in some morally uncomfortable behavior, or were you always able to just trade and scavenge your way through?
I tried just trading and scavenging for as long as I could, and then I wiped a few times. And so I started a playthrough where I decided this time I'm going to steal anything I can and just see what happens. And somebody caught me stealing and shot one of my most capable survivors, the elderly couple who were left at my home. I had like a young woman who was good at sneaking, so I sent her to do all of that out. Mm. And then the two just ordinary people who sat around at home guarding things, because you get raided a lot.
Yeah.
They were doomed from that point onwards. And then I tried again, and basically the same thing happened. It's really hard to actually steal from people. And if you do morally suspect things, it makes your characters more unhappy.
Yeah.
So I, rather than helping someone at one point, I left them to their fate because I didn't want to risk it. And I was just like, no, I'm just going to go over here, steal some stuff and leave. And then the next day, everyone was unhappy. So it does actually punish you for playing that way.
Hmm.
So I don't know. I think in those zombie games, we're used to that kind of thing happening where they steer you towards being a jerk for the sake of surviving. I think people have been playing that way just out of sort of a sense that that's the default thing you do.
Oh, right.
When This War of Mine doesn't really reward you that much for it.
Hmm.
Apparently, I haven't even tried this myself, but if you do murder innocent people and take their stuff, your survivors don't like it. They start arguing with each other, yeah, and getting even more depressed. It goes as far as modeling that.
Well, that's really interesting, actually, that they're taking that route at the very least.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But at the same time, three nights out of four, your house gets raided.
Yeah.
It's just this constant war with people on the outside, as if you're like, you have to board up the windows, you have to leave at least two guards every night, and one of them should probably be armed. It's as if the zombie hordes are still there. There's no real explanation for who these people are, who are every single night hammering on your windows, but they're still there in the game.
Right. Maybe it turns out that the real monster is you.
That's really interesting that they've taken that approach, because I'm just wondering what would happen if there was some sort of apocalyptic situation that happened, you know, in the closer in the future than we'd like. And then we've got a whole audience, like millions of people that have watched shows like The Walking Dead, where...
When you're talking about millions of people, you're talking about our audience, right?
That's right.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, we've got an entire generation of people who watch these survival shows and movies and think that that's the way to survive when the world goes to hell, to just, you know, screw other people and it's all about myself. Like, is that, like, that's a model that some people could use for, like, surviving in that situation.
Well, yeah, the one of the clear inspirations for This War of Mine is A Year in Hell, which is written by a guy named Selko. It's like this article, his account of what he did during the Siege of Sarajevo. And he sells courses online where he will teach you how to survive when the S hits the F. He's this crazy gun nut who sells paranoia to American survivalists. So even ignoring, you know, people who have watched too many zombie shows, then, yeah, there are a lot of people out there stockpiling their bullets and tin cans because they're kind of looking forward to the day when the world ends, yeah, and they will suddenly be useful.
Great.
Yep.
All right. I feel safer already.
Okay, we've been talking about This War of Mine, which is available on the PC.
That's right.
Yep, and is it a sort of a cheap downloadable game, Jody, or is it a full-priced one?
No, it's relatively cheap. 11-Bit Studios are an indie developer. They're the guys who made the Anomaly series. So yeah, it is pretty cheap. You can get it on Steam.
We'll be talking about Far Cry 4 when we return from these songs. The first one is Jonathan Mann. I think this one might require a language warning due to the title. Jody, what is this one?
This song is called Fuck Yes, I'm a Social Justice Warrior. Now, Ray and Lee, you guys have been playing Far Cry 4, and you've been playing it together as well, right? You've been playing it solo and in the co-op mode.
That's right.
Yes, we have.
You've been riding elephants together?
Well...
Not the same elephant.
No. If you could, we would have, but... It's the only vehicle in the entire game where you can't have a buddy clinging tightly behind you, firing a machine gun over your head, which is a shame. But I guess the elephant counts as your other best friend in that situation.
Obviously.
Yeah. So Far Cry 4 is... the Far Cry series is a weird offshoot of games about going to a foreign country and engaging for no real reason in the civil war that's going on there, and also being taunted and chased by crazed wildlife, which you then hunt and turn all their bits into new bags and sacks and belts, right? That's pretty much it. It's an open world bad holiday simulator that's also a first-person shooter. And at their best, they are very inventive and allow you to forge your own path and play according to your own rules. And at their worst, they're... where am I going here? They're ultra-exploitative and all about going to points on the map and making sure that you've collected all the things, because they're also an Ubisoft game.
So where is the terrible holiday destination this time?
You are playing as A.J. Gale, or as he's known in America, A.J. Gale, who is from Karat, a place that doesn't really exist but is basically in Nepal. You've been tasked with the job of returning your mother's ashes to an area in the northern mountain regions. But unfortunately, you get waylaid very early into the game by the current upstart dictator of Karat, and then you get unfortunately dragged into a war between a rebellion force and this kind of interesting villain character. But the story is not great, right? How far into it are you, Ray?
Maybe about a third of the way in.
Yeah. You encounter the villain early into the piece. Because the thing with this game is that it is basically a recreation of the third Far Cry game, which we discussed at some length when it came out last year, year before, whenever that was. But they've smoothed over some of the weird racial issues that people had with that game. But in doing that, they've not necessarily added anything new to the formula. It's definitely an improvement over the previous game, but it also feels like it's retreading a lot of material, and things that were innovative and interesting. The last game had a really compelling and weird sociopath villain that you kept encountering, who kept taunting you and getting up in your face. This game wants to do the same thing out of the gate, but it doesn't really let you interact with him that much. And instead, you keep talking to these rebel faction leaders who are appalling people, right?
Yeah.
They're awful. Like, you have to choose which one of them should lead the rebellion every time you have to help out the Golden Path, and neither one of them should be. Like, they are not fit to lead. They're awful. Like, one guy is boring, and the other woman is desperately wanting to fund a new peaceful regime for free Karat by ensuring that they've got a lot of, like, opium fields and refineries about the place. No! You can't be in charge of a country.
So boring guy sounds kind of okay by comparison.
Yeah, he's fine.
Just boring.
But just dull, you know? It's awful. I didn't want to make that choice. I wanted to just, like, let the weirdo in the pink suit who keeps phoning me up every 4 hours, like, he should be in charge. Like, he's awful. He murders someone in the first 3 minutes of the game. But he's interesting, you know? He's at least got the trains running on time, presumably. So the story is not worth engaging with, like, at all.
Do you need to?
You have to a bit, but then you can do what Ray and I did, which was we played the co-op together, which just lets you play all the other stuff. You can't play any of the story missions, but, you know, it's an Ubisoft game, so there's a lot of other missions just all over this massive map, and you can do whatever you want and just hang out. And it was fantastic, right, Ray?
Yeah, really fun.
What did we do?
Well, like Jody alluded to earlier, we rode elephants. One time I rode in on an elephant with a grenade launcher, and you know what? My elephant didn't finish off, my great grenade launcher did. With Lee by the sidelines, taking care of anyone who was fleeing with a flamethrower.
We're heroes.
Yeah, it sounds like it. So you're taking out, like in Far Cry 3, there's always like an outpost full of dudes and you kill them all and then it's yours.
That's right.
That's
yes.
Right. Yep. Yeah. So part of the fun is strategizing with your co-op partner, who's going to take which role in this siege and the execution of it. And, you know, something always goes wrong and there's always something interesting that happens.
Generally what goes wrong is that Ray will be like, okay, I'm going to take out this guy with my long-range bow. And the first thing, we're like, okay, we'll do this on three. One, two, three. My guy goes down. And then from the other side of the field, I hear, someone's shooting at us.
Yeah, well, that was when I was just starting out.
Okay.
You know, with my marksmanship, but I'm a lot better now.
Okay, good to know.
Yeah.
That's good. Because we still have, like, 50% of that map that we've got to clear.
Yeah. You can also use, like, all of the vehicles that are on the map. One of my favorite ones is the sort of mini light helicopter thing. What do you call one of those?
This one's called the Buzzer, but I believe it's some sort of gyrocopter thing.
Yeah, that's really cool. So you can ride it, and surprisingly, your friend can also jump on the back.
Yeah.
or grapple onto the bottom of it and just like hang around like some sort of crazy Indiana Jones sort of thing.
Yeah.
It sounds like a workplace health and safety nightmare.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Yes. Yeah, we had a great deal of fun just traversing the landscape, discovering that the ATV lets you hop on the back as you drive across the place, and then discovering that the jet skis are also two-man vehicles, which is, I don't know, like it's only a two-person co-op thing, but it is just a massive playground for the two of you then. We should talk about the animals, because they're a weird and big part of it. The wildlife of Karat is varied and well-rendered, so you'll be walking around the village, around a forest, and encounter a snuffling pig or a screeching monkey, or you will then immediately get attacked by an eagle that will get in your face and mess you up. Most of the animals are hostile. Practically all of them are. And they just appear, and they have this like realistically modeled fur, and they're adorable, and generally they're a rare animal. And then they will chase you down a cliff, and then stand over your corpse chittering with glee. And when I first started playing, I felt kind of bad, because in order to expand your belt so that you've got enough guns or you've got enough ammunition to do all these things, you have to hunt down like 8 pigs, right? And then you can carry more than 10 arrows. That's crazy, but okay. Sure, the only way to build a proper container for my arrows is only out of pigs. But I felt bad initially, because I don't want to hurt animals, so I don't want to go out of my way to do that. But then the animals always go out of their way to hurt you. And so by the end of it, when Ray and I were playing, at one point I was piloting a helicopter. He had a massive machine gun, and we were firing into the side of a rhinoceros. I believe this is known as the Sarah Palin hunting technique. And screw that thing, because it's a jerk.
You can also go fishing with C4, like Crocodile Dundee does. Mm-hmm. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah.
And fish you can are also jerks, I'm told.
Oh, yeah. God. Are they ever? Yes.
You can also use the animals against your enemies. There's a lot of caged animals in the camps, and you can free them, and they'll more often than not go on a rampage and do most of the work for you. Mm. Letting loose a tiger in the middle of an enemy camp is a lot of fun.
Yeah. You know those enemies, they're right to cage those animals, right? Like, because they're awful.
Yeah. Why do they keep them around, though, in their home base?
I have no idea I think they're supposed to be trading them. There's a woman who has an arena where she kidnaps you for the obligatory bit in the video game where there are painted boobs for some reason, also in Far Cry 3 now in this one. And you are naked in an arena being attacked by animals, which is intense and weird. And the idea is that all of these enemies are gathering the tigers and what have you together for that later scene. But I have no idea how they possibly managed to transport those animals in the first place without them killing the upper hierarchy of the national army. I have no idea.
How about we just wrap up with our closing thoughts, Lee?
Yeah, sure. So Far Cry 4, despite having a bit of an aff story, it gives you a great many tools and a great deal of options and ways that you can express yourself in the limited ways that you're allowed to interact with things in this world, which is basically shooting them and traversing the environment. It also cuts around the annoyances that a lot of open world games have, where in order to experience one thing, you kind of have to... You sometimes end up doing things that you don't enjoy as much. So, for example, in order to unlock the map, you've got to climb a tower. But if you don't want to do that, this game gives you a lot of tools to just go, you know what? Doesn't matter. You just hop into your helicopter, fly to the top of the tower, no more climbing game. You've solved that problem. This does that all the time. It takes out the roadblocks to fun, which may eventually get tedious. Maybe I won't find the challenge to be there to hold my interest forever. But at the same time, we have put hours into this together. It is a great way to tool around in a beautiful environment with another person who may or may not have a grenade launcher or a crossbow.
Yeah.
Ray, your thoughts?
I think it's very much a product of the Ubisoft formula,
mm-hmm.
But it is an excellent refinement of that formula and definitely worth checking out. One thing that we didn't touch on, I think, enough is the fact that the landscape, it's set in the Himalayas. It's just absolutely stunning.
Amazing.
And it's just fun to explore. Mm. I mean, in a lot of open world games, it's easy just to look at the dots on the map and ignore them or whatever. But here, I just wanted to explore every nook and cranny and see what was out there.
Mm. Yeah, it does a good job of making the landscape varied and interesting enough that it also tends to hide little things that would, if you weren't getting shot at, like 50% of the time, would be amazing tourist trap locations, right?
Yeah.
Like massive statues and hidden temples, things like that are just there the whole way. And every single one of them is guarded by a snake that will bite you because you never see them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Also, the weapons are really cool. We mentioned the grenade launchers, crossbows, sniper rifles and things like that. But there's a really large selection, and you can customize them and do the paint job up and put scopes on them and things like that.
All of my guns are pink.
Yeah.
Every single one.
So it's really fun unlocking and finding new ways to use these weapons, as, you know, as depraved as that sounds. Every time I got a new weapon, I had this itching feeling that I just wanted to try it out, which is a scary feeling.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, for our friends over in the US where gun ownership is a thing. I imagine they must feel a similar feeling when they, you know, unpack a new firearm. Like, hey, I can't wait to try this bad boy out, which I think is a very dangerous feeling to have in real life. In the game, it's fine.
Yeah, you're lucky that I was wearing a headset when you were talking about how you were like, can't wait to shoot this new gun at something. There was no one able to hear that who wasn't me. Well, and all of the listeners that I just shared that anecdote with.
Yep.
So anyway, Ray, he's dangerous. That's the summary of Far Cry 4.
Far Cry 4. Look, next week we have an interview with Alex Hutchison, who is the creative lead on Far Cry 4, so tune in next week at the same time to hear that. But for now, we're out of here. We will be saying goodbye, and farewell.
Good ending, Ray.
Yeah.
Finish on that. Finish on a high note.
I will. All right, but let's hear one more track. This one is by Nitro Fun. It's called New Game. We'll see you guys next week.
Bye.
Bye.